music by Casket Bound.
Hello again. Welcome to the show. I'm here with my co-presenter, Rachel Haywire. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello.
You didn't say hello, Rachel. People were very disappointed last time. You didn't say
hello. Oh, well, you can only do a joke a few times before you become the joke.
Well, true, true. Some things get better with repetition, but that's probably not one of them.
True.
So, as usual, we're discussing a topic with a kind of technological spin on it. And today we're talking about how technology interfaces with art and how it affects it and vice versa. So I think it's useful if I just kind of sketch out what I've seen as being the sort of long historical view of that. So when art really kind of started, as we think of it, maybe sort of medieval times and so on, it was not accurate. It was not in proportion. There was no perspective to it. It was a kind of metaphorical representation of something that people could kind of figure out what it was or had cultural references to it that helped them understand it, all that sort of thing. As the technology of art progressed, so we get into the Renaissance and people crack perspective and optics and all that kind of stuff, it becomes much more an attempt to represent reality, even using camera obscura, things like that. But then photography comes into the scene, and, you know, why spend all that time and effort carefully measuring and drawing a picture in perfect proportions when you can just snap a picture? And then art turned more into something more abstract or impressionistic and so on. We can see how that's gone until today. You can go to the Tate Modern and someone's just painted a canvas a single color, and that's considered art. So, you know, things change.
I think a lot of the art scene is based on inside jokes and references and cool points, you know, getting it. A lot of it is about getting it. So when you're going to a gallery and you're looking at art and it's just like one color with a dot on it,
yeah,
it's not really about the color and the dot. It's about being in the know. I mean, I think being in the know is part of what drives the art economy. And it's been that way for a while. I think that has been a facet of the art industry.
Yeah. Having a label on clothing, kind of, yeah, it gives it a certain cachet.
Right. The brand names are about the status, and the status sells the clothing.
Yeah, and then fame feeds itself, because the more important someone is seen as being, yeah, the more their work takes value, then the more people pile on and want more of it.
Which is why if you create, like, 10 fake accounts and boost your own algorithm, you're going to be doing really good.
Oh, don't tell people that.
You just keep liking your own content. You got, like, 10 accounts. I don't know. I mean, people do that now out of necessity. That's what I find strange, is for people to get their content recognized, whether it's art or film or photography, that they kind of have to hire a robot army to, like, get recognized at all.
Yeah. Was that a truck reversing in your apartment?
No, I just have people over here.
Okay.
But I mean, they could be doing cool, sinister things.
Yeah, true.
No, I have two guests in Vermont town, actually.
Cool. Yeah, we think we've done away with all the alert sounds this time, so.
No more intrusive notification sounds. I was just thinking about, like, how Discord has the worst notification sounds ever, and they're absolutely relentless, especially if you're on more than 5 Discord channels.
Yeah.
Every single time that somebody sends a message, you get a bleep. It's too much. Nobody can handle that many bleeps. This is like some torture, you know, sci-fi movie.
Yeah, and you can mute them. You can mute them, but then you have to go through all the channels you've joined on a whim trying to find the one that you haven't muted.
Oh, man. Like, I turned my Discord notification sounds off. It took me way too long to figure it out. And I'm somebody who's been online for a long time. It seems like it shouldn't have taken me that long to figure out how to turn off their sounds. Are these sounds like music? Are they like trying to control their brainwaves? You know, like, what are these sounds? Where do they come from? Is it like musicians, or are they trying to like promote their tracks to us with their
with the beeping, the endless messages?
Check out my other hits.
Well, we can segue that usefully. Music, audio, that's something that's been very much affected by technology. So I think vinyl is outselling other hard media for music again now, which is weird.
I think it's great. I was a vinyl collector. I had my favorite bands, all their records. I was into early industrial, dark ambient, neo-folk, all that stuff. I had Kurt 93 and Coil, Throbbing Gristle, Interested in Noiva there. And I got all of my vinyl on eBay. I paid a lot for it. It was a collector thing for me. My vinyl was my pride and my joy.
But what about the sound, though? Do you genuinely think it's better?
Incredible, yeah. Yeah, it was very warm and very organic, very in the room with me. I felt like the bands were there with me. Even then, you know, when MP3s were kind of the rage, but CDs were still a thing, there was a very different experience when I would listen to a CD or an MP3 or a record. Each experience was completely different.
Mm. Do you think part of it's the ritual of putting vinyl on? Because, you know, you have to carefully take out its sleeve, hold it by the edges, blow the dust off, put it onto the table.
You know. It feels good to put a record on. It feels fun and kind of slick. You know, you just feel good when you spin a record. You know, and you move the needle and then the song plays and you're just like, yeah. It is a good feeling. It's a good feeling.
And it kind of forces you to listen to the album rather than the individual track. I know that's something people have said, that the experience of listening to an album and the message and interplay between the different tracks is something that's been lost.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the downside is obviously just that you have to do a lot of maintenance if you're listening to a record. Because, you know, it's like a half hour has gone by and then you got to flip the record. So that can be kind of annoying. But all in all, like, I think vinyl is a great medium. You know, when we've had everything from cassettes to, you know, discs, you know, mini discs and CDs and MP3s and, you know, FLAX and, you know, I mean, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's going to be like a new type of vinyl in the cloud. Cloud vinyl. I don't know. The sky is the limit, right?
Someone with a warehouse full of record players that streams the track over the internet to you.
Funded.
Yeah, it plays the album and it mines Bitcoin at the same time.
Oh, there you go. So you can get more crypto every time you listen to a track by your favorite artist. And they have their own altcoin. So if you're listening to a band like, let's just go with, what's a band that everybody knows? See, I don't know, Cardi B, okay? I don't know what people know. I'm just going to assume people know Cardi B, who I don't know, but I know that people know her. So I think that she's a her. I don't know. I don't want to misgender anybody. Okay, Cardi B, I think, is a woman. Is that correct? Is that much correct?
As far as I'm aware, yes.
Okay. So say that you listen to a Cardi B track. Every time you listen to that track, you get Cardi coin.
Or you could call it platinum instead of platinum.
Platinum. Hook up my wallet. I think it scammed. How do I know I'm getting really, you know, Cardi coin? How do I, platinum.
But isn't the fidelity of a CD better? Isn't that a reason to get a CD over vinyl?
I don't know anybody that gets CDs anymore, except for in Austin, Texas. So I was in Austin for a few months, God help me. And there was a scene of people that only listened to CDs. And they made CDs. They produced them. They released them. They manufactured them. They gave them out to each other. That's just the Austin scene. They're not really focused on digital. They're not really focused on vinyl. They're just all CDs all the time. And that's just what's up over there. But that's not common. I don't know very many people who have CDs outside of Austin. Maybe like, you know, collectors. But I mean, most people, they just have digital files now.
Yeah. So is that like the successor to mixtapes? People putting CDs together for each other?
Yeah. Yeah, because I remember, well, we had all talked about being a member of an old online forum for comics called the Barbalith Underground, right?
Yeah, Barbalith, yeah.
Barbalith, right. And we would make each other mixtapes, and we started making each other mix CDs.
I don't remember you being on there. I was on there loads.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was a troll. I was like one of the first people to get banned.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough.
I upset the overlords. I was like 17, if even that. You know, I was literally just some chick trying to smash the state, you know, and they were all like, let's create policy. And I'm like, the only policy I know is chaos. You know, it was a different time in my life. But what I do remember, like, despite the fact that I was an annoying juvenile troll, was that I was taken in by a lot of my, I guess, cultural elders, and they began sending me mixed cassettes, and I began sending them mixed cassettes, and this was how I discovered a lot of the music that I'm into to this day. And I remember I listened to a band called The Walkmen, and I just loved them, looked through their entire discography. They sent me like weird hippie stuff. There was a song, it was called the Village Green Preservation Society. Just this completely insane, like hippie cult track that I just played for all my friends for years to come. And, you know, and then we started doing CDs. And it was a very similar, you know, like almost like zines. It was just very like DIY, you know, share your music with your internet friends across the world, trade. You know, I mean, I think that was a really cool time, actually.
So what do people do now? Do they send each other playlists?
I mean, okay. So I'm a musician. I don't release as much music as I used to. I used to have a fairly popular electro-industrial project. And back then, we were actually still printing CDs. So even if it was a limited run, right, we would do a limited run of 500 albums. You know, small record labels, you don't want to print out more than 500. And then I would sell them to retailers. I would mail them to my fans. I eventually found an intern to go to the post office every day for me and mail my CDs out. Having to take care of my intern and the cost of printing out the CDs as a record label owner, I did not even break even. Like I lost money being a musician. So later on in my life, I was like, I'm just going to make my music for fun. And then I released it on Bandcamp. And now it's like you can download it and you can pay for it if you want to. I recommend it. Experiment Haywire. Alternative Technology was my last album. Definitely download it. Definitely, you know, give me money if you like my music. But I'm not expecting to make. I make maybe. I don't even know if I should say it so low. Like $30 a month on my music on a good month.
I was going to say I'm an indie author. You can't shock me with how little money you make, but you just managed it.
Yeah. $30 in a good month. But I'm not trying to make a living with my music. I'm just releasing my music for fun. I don't expect to make that a side hustle. The music that I make is not accessible. It doesn't have commercial value. And I don't want to make music like that. The stuff that I do that's commercial value is my design work. I am just an underground musician who's stayed true to my sound. And, you know, I make music as a hobby. And I don't make it as much as I used to, but I enjoy making it when I do.
It's all about marketing, which most creative people are terrible at.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Yeah, we can't all be Salvador Dali or Pablo Picasso when it comes to self-promotion.
Why do you think that creative people are bad at marketing? What do you think is the correlation there?
I have a theory, right, that most great artists are great because they don't believe in their own talent. So they're always second-guessing and they're always perfecting and so on. It's because they're never really satisfied with what they're doing. It's always, oh, this is crap. I can do better than this. Mm-hmm. But then it's very hard to sell what you've made if you think it's shit.
Okay. So, I mean, I think what you're saying, I don't want to interpret this wrong, is that because artists are more passionate and human and real, that they're constantly revising and very self-critical, and that they don't feel confident promoting themselves because they care so much. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be about what I would say. Yeah.
Okay, so say that you're somebody trained, you know, by some college for, you know, music producers or whatever, right? How much would that change things? Because I went to the School of Audio Engineering in New York City, and I trained to become an engineer, right? But I actually just ended up becoming a producer and starting my own label. And I mean, there were a lot of people that went to that school who ended up becoming engineers for like P. Diddy, you know, and like Jay-Z, you know, they get Jay-Z the Coca-Cola, you know, as they hook up his equipment. But that was never what I wanted. I mean, no offense toward Jay-Z, who is obviously listening to our podcast now.
Obviously.
Hi, Jay-Z. Good to see you, right? But like that, I just didn't really see that as something that would make me happy.
Yeah, so I'm an art school dropout to fulfill a stereotype, you know?
Same. We both are. We share this.
But I found that basically 1 year I did at art school extremely useful in the things that I learned and the things I observed in other people who were working more than the teachers. But my art education is one of having my soul crushed over and over again.
Because
they just didn't. No one understood what I was doing or what I was interested in, and didn't value it. So, you know. But the stubbornness kind of carried me through, even though I don't really use the art education very much. It's still very useful in publishing. So I think I have a pretty good grasp of it, of aesthetic and what works and what doesn't.
I mean, I went to art school. I definitely don't feel like it was the best place for creative people who were really on their own path, but it definitely gave me a lot of foundational knowledge I did not have before. While I had to do a lot of projects that were very basic and didn't inspire me, there were also some cool projects that I did. Like I had to make a film on a Bolox camera, pure black and white. You know, you can only take one shot. You know, you got one chance to make that shot. It's a black and white film that I made. Had a really good time making it. And then there were also times where I would just make my own projects. You know, if I did an assignment and I finished the criteria, if I had another idea that was really cool, I would just do that on my own. And then I started like rounding up my friends at art school and getting them to model for my fashion company. You know, so I had a fashion company in art school, and my friends in art school were modeling for me. So I was like an art school dropout who became an entrepreneur while I was in art school.
Yeah.
So it kind of like all converged.
And to bring us kind of back onto topic a bit, one of the challenges I ran into at art school was, so I was into illustration and comics, and they thought that was frivolous and pointless. And I was also interested in how computers could be used in art. And there was not a single computerized device in the entire art department.
That seems wrong.
That's, yeah, this would have been, what, mid-90s.
'93,
'94, something like that.
I mean, because we had computers, but a lot of it was for video editing or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We had, like, painting classes. We just had canvases and paintbrushes. And we just had, like, paint. You know, we didn't have the option of, like, editing our physical paintings with the school computers. But they did teach us how to make a website and create a portfolio. I dropped out too because I was doing my own thing and I was getting enough traction financially at the time to not have to stay in art school. And I just found it a bit confining. So yeah. I'm like, all right, this was great. I love you guys. I'm moving forward. I've got these skills. But the thing is that not everybody who goes to art school even becomes an artist.
No.
A lot of people become assistants or they become, executive managers. They become bookkeepers. Sweep the floors of Pixar. You know, like you're not guaranteed. A lot of people, they launch their own independent careers and they have side hustles, which they're bringing in a good amount of income, but they still have to work a non-art job on the side.
It's weird. Like an art school education, even if you drop out, seems to be good for other things that aren't art. Mm-hmm. It's like, almost no decent journalists have been to journalism school. All the really good journalists haven't studied journalism.
That's so true, because the most authentic voices are going to be the ones that aren't adhering to a formula.
Yeah, yeah. I just thought, though, something that I never experienced while I was at art school was the impact of the kind of smartphone, because, you know, we didn't even have cameras on our phones in the early and mid-90s. So, you know, if I stayed home one day because I was sick and didn't go in, then I missed a figure drawing class and there was no way to participate. But if someone today missed a class, someone could just take a couple of pictures of the model and send them to them.
That's true. But I do wonder, like, if you're going to art school on Zoom, are you really getting an experience of making art in real life and getting feedback? I mean, and I'm not a good painter, but I at least remember in my painting classes that my instructors would physically come by and give me feedback on what I was painting and be able to direct me.
Yeah, it must be difficult.
Zoom.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing I've seen is even traditional artists, like who do go out, they will take pictures of what they're painting so they can capture that single frozen moment, and then they will paint from the picture rather than necessarily from the real life around them, because it helps them capture the light in that moment.
I think that's cool.
And the transitory things, like maybe there's some ducks on the pond in a particular position or whatever.
And there's all sorts of variations on this. Like you can make a painting, take a picture of the painting, edit it on Blender, you know, and do a really cool digital rendition of your painting. And I mean, I think that's kind of incredible, actually. Like the painting might be really beautiful, but you might make a really cool digital rendition of it that's equally beautiful, if not even better, you know, that there's so many possibilities for this.
Yeah. I know some museums are doing things with, like, augmented reality. So you can wear a headset while you go around. And then when you look at a particular painting, it will come up with information about it.
Yeah.
Start playing the audio, you know, things like
that. This is where the metaverse and the NFT world starts getting exciting, even though it's only in its beginning stages right now. Just the ability to, like, fully immerse yourself in somebody's art on a virtual reality scale is absolutely incredible. Especially as the technology improves and, you know, Apple comes out with their headsets, the user experience becomes more accessible. You know, the possibilities of art are like, wow. You know, just, I mean, even like the Van Gogh Museum and all that stuff, you know, where they're creating live experiences. Mm. You know, I think the character of art is changing to become more immersive, and I think that's exciting, and there are always going to be the dumb inside jokes, like, haha, did you get it? Here's a black line on a red canvas. But I think there are always going to be true artists. I don't think that will ever change.
Do you think overall, though, that technology has perhaps been corrosive to art? So at the start of the show, you know, I was pointing out we've got this arc from unrealistic art to realistic art and back to unrealistic art. Do you think that kind of realism that is possible with technology squeezes artists out in a way?
Yes and no. I mean, the more popular opinion, I guess, with like the true artists is that technology has made art more fake. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that a lot of art has become much better because of technology. I also think that because you can make art with AI now, that all these people who previously didn't have the ability to make art are now generating it through artificial intelligence and curating it really well and putting their own spin on it and making incredible galleries, and that what they're doing is actually really fantastic. Even if an AI did it for them, the point is that the final output, and I also think there were a lot of traditional artists that have embraced technology, that have begun making art with AI. They've begun blending their AI art with their physical art. There are all sorts of mediums and mixes and possibilities for what you can do with art physically and digitally and how you can combine them.
Yeah, that's something I've found really fascinating with this rise in AI art, right? So throughout history, when we have depicted computers or androids or robots or whatever making art, right, it's always been sort of high fidelity to reality art, like Data on Star Trek, you know, when he first starts painting, all he can do is paint exactly what's there. He's got no creativity, doesn't understand abstract, right? He's incapable of doing that. And that was always how we thought about computers and AI doing art, that they would not have the soul or the spark to do something weird, emotional, abstract. But then we look at the AI art today, and it is fantastically abstract. It's
really incredible. Actually, I use this program, and I love it. It is called Dream. You can put in a string of words, and the AI will generate art for you based on these words. And you can even choose what kind of style you want. You can choose, like, Baroque, Vibrant, Dark Fantasy, steampunk. You know, you can choose any of these aesthetics, and the AI will take this string of words and make some art for you. So you could type in, you know, anything you're interested in, and boom, you've got this AI generated art. And I think that is so cool.
So the artist's input in that instance then is selecting the words and then curating the output, not actually the production of the art itself.
Well, they're selecting the words, they're choosing the style, they're curating the output, like you said, but they're also marketing the art, so they're also using creative ways to get it out. Some of them are minting their art as NFTs and coming up with campaigns. There's all sorts of cool stuff. And then there's also, you know, like blending the AIR with physical art. There's also editing the AIR physically. There's also taking the AIR and playing with it with your skills, you know, whether you're using Photoshop or Blender or one of many apps that I use. I play with a lot of apps to edit my art, like Hyperspective and Pixomatic, and I'll use AIR to play with, you know, and give my own personal touch to it.
Well, that used to be a technique, didn't it? People would just like throw paint at a canvas randomly and then take what came and turn it into something.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool. And I mean, when it comes down to it, I'm going to choose some really good AI art over some inside joke in a gallery about a black line on a red canvas. In fact, you know what? James, the next time I go to a gallery and I'm going to see like some inside joke in the no art that's very, very bad, I'm just going to be like, have you ever tried AI? If the artist is there, I'm just going to be like, yeah, you should focus on artificial intelligence. Just not like look them dead in the eye.
Yeah, then you can put all your effort into the bullshit.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I think Andy Warhol was one of the people who made a good example of how stupid people were and what they were willing to consume. And I've been thinking about Andy Warhol a lot. There was a documentary about him that came out recently on Netflix. And I am of the opinion that his art was not the Campbell's soup cans or the Marilyn Monroe's. Like, I think his art was social commentary. And his art was the factory scene. His art, his actual art, was all the people that would come by to check out his soup cans and the reactions. Yeah. He was a troll, a performance artist, a social philosopher.
Yeah, so he was curating and being selective, not really necessarily producing much himself.
Yeah, he was also like exposing people's desire for status and for fame. He was showing how easy it was to get people to engage in certain things just based on, you know, like social factors. He was kind of like showing people how dumb they were. I think he was brilliant at it. But this could just be like my fringe Warhol take. But I'm not the only person who has this take about Andy Warhol.
Yeah, I've heard similar things from people. I find the AI abstract thing amusing because artists and writers and everyone, we all used to be quite smug that, oh, we'll be the last ones to be replaced by computers.
Well, I mean, we're seeing joint collaborations between artists and computers now. And I mean, the purists that never do anything with technology, I don't fault them. It's not my job to be like, hey, you should use technology to make your art better. I'm like, no, like if you're making great art, you're making great art. I don't care what medium you're using. I know a painter in Arizona, she never uses technology for anything, and her paintings are absolutely incredible. They're in galleries worldwide. Her paintings are from the heart. They are true. They are transformative. She doesn't use computers. But her art is so good that she is still a world-recognized artist who is making a living with her art. She's just that good.
Yeah. I still think technology can have a negative effect on art, though. Like, for example, I was watching a kid's cartoon on Netflix, which is like a saggy samurai rabbit. And it's very, very loosely derived from the old Usagi Yojimbo comics from back in the day, if anyone who's listening has heard of them. But it's all done with CG, and it's meant to be the descendant of the original Usagi. But the CG is bad. It's obviously done cheaply and quickly because CG is easy and cheap to produce in, but it's just that the animation has no weight to it. It's very robotic. It's not even as good as computer games today.
Just laziness.
Well, that's what's frustrating about it, because occasionally in the series there will be a flashback to his ancestor, the original Usagi Yojimbo. Yeah. And that's done, it's still done using computers, but it's done in a way that looks more like traditional animation or Japanese brush art. And that's fantastic. And if they'd done the whole series in that style, I'd have been a very happy camper, but they just didn't. So, you know, it's obvious that they can do it, but they're not doing it.
I guess they're lazy, and if people are willing to consume it, what incentive do they have to make things good?
Yeah. But then,
if you're producing t-shirts and they say, fuck you, you know, like, eat my pussy or whatever, and like you're selling thousands of these t-shirts a day, why are you going to improve the quality of the cotton?
Yeah, well, there are programs that just kind of put random catchphrases on t-shirts and then push them out to Amazon.
Yeah, but if you've got a really good hustle and you're not really putting high quality material into it and your hustle is sustaining, you know, you're bringing in like $100K a month doing some low quality stuff, you're bringing in $100K a month.
Yeah, yeah. It's like spam emails. You just got to fool someone once, you know?
Right. I mean, I guess some people, they don't need to up their game. You see, you know, underground artists and musicians and filmmakers and comic book writers, photographers, that are all upping their game really hard. And then you see really famous, you know, like really influential people who don't have their game at all.
Yeah.
And they're doing just fine.
Kanye, for example.
Kanye? Kanye? Is that like when you're doing some coke? Like, can I don't know. Like, I don't listen to these people's music, honestly. I mean, I think Kanye is funny on the internet. That's about it. But when you're seeing all of these independent artists that are working really hard and they've really upped their game and their art is just, wow, you know, and you see that art and it's selling, you know, there's a lot going on here about merit and status and talent,
yeah,
and insider connections and, oh my God, there's just so much. Like, where, yeah, do you even start?
And that critical acclaim doesn't necessarily translate to success anymore either.
Right. And also there are a lot of people that just imitate what other successful artists do. You know, like you have a lot of people that they're trying to be the new Banksy, you know, and their art, it's obviously, it's like, oh, that looks like Banksy.
Yeah.
You know, and even like the Bored Ape Yacht Club, those NFTs are not good art. I'm sorry, dude. those Bored Apes look ugly. But you got hundreds of people making their own Bored Apes now, and they're calling it like Bored Ape Pirate Club or like Bored, you know, Kitten Yacht Club or, you know, Angry Ape, you know, Cruise Ship, you know, and yeah, they're all just copying the Bored Apes that aren't even good looking to begin with, you know. It's
why would you spend so much on a status symbol when what that status symbol says is I'm a gullible asshole?
Because the majority of people don't have souls and they just copy what's doing well, and that's all that comes into it. They just copy what's doing well. But this is why I like people like Andy Warhol and, you know, Michel Duchamp, because they realized how dumb people were and they exploited them for being dumb as part of their art. You know, like the whole toilet is this art. That wasn't like an attempt to make art. That was an attempt to get people to think about how they viewed art and to demonstrate the absurdity of the whole scene. So I think Duchamp is a genius because he kind of threw that culture back in people's face, just like Warhol. You know, it's not about a toilet. It's not about a soup can.
Yeah. There's kind of a weird, somewhat similar dichotomy in like video games at the moment as well. So on the one hand, you've got these AAA massive titles that are making, you know, more money than Hollywood. And most of those seem to go for a very realistic aesthetic. They try to get as photorealistic as possible. And then, primarily for budgetary reasons, I think more than anything else, you've got this indie scene where the art is a lot more stylized, or it's throwback to the limitations of the 8-bit and 16-bit days. Yeah, and that becomes much more stylistic and in a lot of ways a lot more interesting than the photorealistic art, but it doesn't necessarily make that much money. But then more recently, that started to bleed back across. So a really big game like Fortnite is very stylized, has a very cartoony aesthetic. It's not going for that photorealism, but that's a new thing that's going on.
I think it depends on the developer. I mean, you know, games like Fortnite are really high end and they attract a wide audience of people. They have good funding. They have a good team behind them and they're making wonderful things and they're doing it right. You've got really big game companies that are making really bad art. They're doing it wrong. And then with the indie creators, it's different because like you said, you know, you're getting the low 8-bit quality stuff that's kind of nostalgic throwback. I was playing the Oregon Trail, you know, like on my iPhone the other day. It was very lo-fi. It looked exactly like the original that I played on Windows 95 in elementary school, if you want to know how old I am. And it was great. You know, I like felt like I was back in school playing Oregon Trail on my in my computer lab, right? And then, yeah, like you also mentioned, there is the really high quality indie game development. I think a lot of these people are in two categories. Maybe three categories. One, they have fuck you money. Two, they have a lot of free time. Three, they are that good.
Yeah.
And, you know, the latter category is a small percentage. But I can think of a few games like that. For example, there's a game, I don't know if you've heard of it, it's called Holo Vista. It was like one of the first vaporwave aesthetic games that was done really well. The art is absolutely beautiful. Do you remember Coil House magazine?
Vaguely.
It was an avant-garde magazine for musicians and fashion designers and just very weird creative people that were pushing the limits. And two of the founders of Coil House magazine, they developed a game called Holo Vista a few years ago. And it is beautiful. It is just, oh my God. You know, and maybe like for every one game like that, there are going to be like 50 just like low quality, you know, pixelated, you know, stupid ass shit, right?
Yeah.
But you're always going to find diamonds in the rough.
Yeah. It's this pursuit of photorealism, right? They still can't quite get there, and it just ends up looking odd. So sometimes I think it's better to lean into the stylistic representations.
Okay, so you're talking about like the uncanny valley of art.
Yeah.
I see.
Because they create this expectation that things are going to look super realistic, and then in those moments where they don't, it completely throws you off. Whereas with the stylistic content, you know, you are, okay, this isn't going to look realistic, I'm going to suspend my disbelief.
You know? Well, you know, who did that well, like 15, 20 years ago, was Richard Linklater, when he did Waking Life. You remember Waking Life? They did it in a cartoon way, but it was also, like, very, very realistic. So they turned the live characters into cartoons, and the animation was really, really well put together. It had its own style completely, and it was just done very well.
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of movies like that. I mean, you know, like when it started to become bad, in my opinion, was actually, and maybe this is just because I am a fan of like early MTV cyberpunk, but Aeon Flux. I loved the show on MTV. I obsessively watched every episode multiple times. I had the DVD collection. And then the live-action Aeon Flux movie came out with very bad CGI.
Yeah.
And it was a disgrace.
Why would you even do that? Why wouldn't you do a full-length animated movie?
Yeah, and there's a lot of that. Like, it's been going on since, what, like Tomb Raider? I remember a lot of video games, but they turned into really bad movies. They're objectively bad. It's not even, like, an opinion. You know, like, these movies are bad.
I'm fairly friendly with Drew Newman, who did the music for Aeon Flux. You can buy the soundtrack from his website if you're interested.
And he did the music for the original cartoon.
He did the music for the cartoon. Yeah.
Then when we get off this podcast chat, you know, I mean, info, and I'm gonna fangirl him.
Okay. He's into Dungeons and Dragons, so.
I'll just tell him that I'm chaotic neutral, but that I don't play the game. I hope he finds me charming, well, not annoying.
He's one of the few people to fanboy over me. So,
okay, so we've got a fanboy circle jerk.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's a triangle jerk because there's three of us. I've got to get my jerks right.
It's difficult to jerk triangles. Too many corners.
Have you ever tried to jerk a trapezoid? One time in geometry,
it's like one time in band camp.
I stuck a oh my god, honestly, that movie was bad. Can we just talk about like how bad American Pie was?
It was bad.
How many idiots thought it was good?
Yeah.
Like how bad people's tastes are. Like can we just say people have bad tastes?
So the problem is mediocre consumers. That we need better consumers.
Is that people get bad? They got bad taste. They only like what's successful because they can't discriminate what's good and bad anymore. Conservative philosopher Roger Scruton talked about how people didn't understand beauty anymore. They didn't understand what good art was. They didn't understand what beautiful architecture and uplifting music was to them. They couldn't tell the difference between an opera
and
you know,
cover you cut out for a second there. Opera and
a really bad cover band. They lost their ability to discriminate good art from bad art, and that this had devastating consequences for culture and society.
But isn't it a good thing that we've got rid of gatekeepers, though, that tell us what's good and bad art?
I don't think we have.
No.
I don't think that if the only way that you can get recognized is if you're, you know, well, I mean, look, you can get recognized if you're really good, if you're exceptional, you know, but everybody else, you know, if they need to know some celebrity or they need to make their art look more like an already known artist so they can get traction. You know, you see the same thing with bands, right? They release an incredible full-length album, but the only track of theirs that gets any play is a cover song. So, no, we still have massive gatekeeping. We haven't gotten rid of it at all.
I don't know. I'm in two minds about it. Both with art and things like news. Like I appreciate the fact that stuff can just bubble up and be popular randomly because people latch onto it, or you know, independent people can produce news. But at the same time, I think there needs to be some sort of gatekeeping.
No, otherwise, we need a different kind of gatekeeping than what we have.
Yeah,
that we have is just like based on like celebrity cred. What we also have is like that, I don't know, 18-year-old kid who like made millions just like selling pictures of rocks. Like I think we need some gatekeeping there.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe making pictures of rocks shouldn't make you a multi-billionaire. I mean, call me a gatekeeper, you know. where do we enforce some standards? I mean, we're not talking about like burning art that is abstract, but we're just saying like this is bad art. These rocks are ugly. The emperor is naked. I mean, I think we really do need to distinguish between good art and bad art, and not pretend like we think art or music is good simply because it's popular and we want to fit in. I mean, that's how society declines.
Yeah. Trouble is, it's also subjective. That's the...
I mean, no, some art is actually objectively good.
Mm.
Like, I can go to a gallery and I can be completely transfixed by a painting and know that it is the best painting in the gallery by far. And I can stare at that painting for 20 minutes and I can look around the gallery, look at some other paintings. They might not be, you know, as captivating. And I will notice other people that stare at that same painting as me for 20 minutes. That is good art.
Yeah. It's interesting. Some of the best fantasy artists that I know of have initially trained to be very realistic in their depictions. Mm. Like Tim White, he was a hyper-realist before he got into fantasy art. So he would use projections and then paint over the top of the projection on the canvas to end up with something that had kind of the same fidelity as a photograph, really. But then he took that skill and that ability to represent very realistic looking things, and he applied it to science fiction and fantasy and all of that kind of thing, and it works.
Nice. That sounds cool.
So
I think you just focus on the good art that you like and maybe ignore the bad stuff.
Yeah. Though sometimes it's hard to ignore this stuff, right? So film is something where I really notice technology changing things, right? So we've gone from 24 frames per second analog grainy film to 60 frames per second 4K resolution stuff, right? And there is nowhere to hide in 4K 60 FPS. Like, makeup effects look bad, CGI looks worse, the lighting can look off. The first time I noticed it was watching Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy, which was done at, you know, 4K and 60 FPS.
Okay.
And more recently, like just tonight, I watched Venom 2 in 4K and 60 FPS. And it's just everything looks awful. I don't know if it's just me being an old fuddy-duddy or what.
You're doing God's work. You cannot pay me to watch these films.
Well, I find Venom funny, but it's just looking at the visuals.
All right. Well, I would find it funny if that movie wasn't playing anymore.
But have you watched any really high res, really high FPS films at all recently? Have you been to the cinema? Or?
Yeah, so I don't watch superhero movies because I don't like them. I like Love, Death, and Robots, which aired on Netflix a few years ago, and I think they have a lot of high fidelity, high quality animation that was done really well. It looked great. Loved the show.
Have you seen the Oates Studio stuff as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a friend that just showed me or something. Also fantastic.
Yeah, Niels Blomkamp, his stuff.
He's great.
Yeah, he does really good stuff with technology.
Yeah.
He has a very identifiable visual style, even though he's going for realism and so on.
Yeah, which I think is great. You know, and I think that there are people like him that are leading a charge for really good, hyper-realistic, high-fidelity art, and that's the stuff that we should be paying attention to. And, you know, sometimes I feel like we just criticize stuff too much because we're, like, all jaded punk internet hipsters or whatever. You know, sometimes it's like something's bad. Oh, well, we can forget about the bad thing because there's some really good stuff over here. Let's go check out the good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole... It's very easy to get sucked into this whole genre on YouTube of just hating everything and getting angry at everything.
I don't mind you saying the word toxic. Because I think it's toxic to throw the word toxic around too much. But that's some toxic content, bro. You got to plug out. You got to plug out if it's toxic.
But I'm always looking for something positive. But a lot of these curmudgeons are right. A lot of this stuff is awful.
But what's the point in watching a video of somebody commenting on somebody else's video being bad when you can just watch a good video?
Well, it can warn you that something is bad.
Okay, but you've got two choices. You can watch a really great movie, or you can watch a random person on YouTube talk about a bad movie.
Yeah.
Why are you going to choose the latter?
We were talking about this the other night on another show I do called The Weekend Geek, the T-shirted historian on YouTube. Cool. And we got into this kind of meta discussion as like, why do we keep doing this to ourselves? You know, a new series comes along. Maybe it's from an old comic book property that we used to read as kids, or maybe it's another Star Wars or a Star Trek or something. And yeah, we know it's going to be bad, but we hope it's going to be good. So, you know, you just, you build, you allow yourself to hope. And then you just get crushed.
See, I won't do that. If I know a movie is going to be bad, there's no way that I'm going to see it. Like, I just won't go. And if I do go to see a movie, I have to know that it's going to be good. There are three movies that I want to see that just came out. One of them is Everything All at Once. I've heard incredible things from people's opinions who I trust. I don't want any spoilers, but I know it's going to be amazing. I want to see the new Batman. I heard it was kind of like a film noir kind of 90s MTV aesthetic that was just really well orchestrated. I want to see that. And I want to see the new Doctor Strange, because I remember seeing the first one in theaters, and I generally don't like comic book movies at all. But I loved Doctor Strange. I'm looking forward to the new one. I can reliably assume that all three of these movies are going to be good. So I'm going to see them. But if I don't know, maybe it's going to be good. Like, I just won't go.
Well,
why would I do that to myself?
I won't spoil anything about the Doctor Strange film, but at least it's directed by Sam Raimi, who we know is good. So,
yeah, I've got hopes. I mean, yeah.
Okay, here's the other thing, though, then. This is the topic we'll wrap up on, okay? Yeah, we can go and watch something good that we know is good, right? But it's becoming increasingly difficult to actually own any of this stuff.
Right. Okay. This is a big issue that is so significant on its own. We could probably do an entire episode on it.
Yeah. But we won't.
No, but we can just wrap it up with this. We'll summarize it. You used to be able to have a lot of vinyl and CDs, and, you know, some people still do, but most of us don't. I ended up selling all of my vinyl. I don't even know where my cassette tapes are, probably buried in some storage box in some friend's basement in some city I don't remember. I have a lot of music on Spotify now, but I don't really have the music. It's just music that I listen to on Spotify. You know, if I have friends come over and they want to play music, they'll often just play something off of YouTube. And I don't know about that. I don't know about that.
Yeah, and so it's weird. Like, Netflix, or what became Netflix, used to have a bigger selection
when
it was DVDs in the mail, right?
Yeah, they mailed you the DVDs. I remember the Netflix DVD days. Those were good days.
We went through so much obscure Hong Kong martial arts cinema during the time when you're being mailed CDs.
Yeah. Well, isn't it dematerialization? Isn't there an effort to bring everything into the cloud? So, you know, you're an environmentalist agenda related to this.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so there's a bunch of different problems here, right? Firstly, physical media deteriorates, right? Yeah,
that's true.
But, so, and in theory, if something's on the internet, it's on the internet forever. But in practice, we're finding out that that's not the case. Like, if I want to see the original unenhanced Star Wars films, where the fuck can I go to get them? Other than piracy sites, you know?
You've gotta be like a hacker. You've gotta type in a bunch of phrases and copy a bunch of URLs and edit them.
Yeah. Or if I want to watch E.T., where the feds still have guns instead of walkie-talkies, where can I do that?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question, and if anybody has the answer, please leave it in the comments or watch his original E.T. I would say, you know, like, you can get director's cuts on eBay. I'm a big Natural Born Killers fan, you know, and if you want the director's cut, you can get it on eBay. eBay is good for that.
Yeah.
Lots of possibilities.
And then there's issues with regionalization. So that, like, if I want to buy a particular film, maybe I can't get it for my region, which means I then have to have a separate DVD or whatever player that's region free. There's just all these obstacles.
Pain. Well, what I would say, you know, share your thoughts with us about being able to get rare media in this day and age, because there's so many different ways that you could be doing it now, but it's very difficult now.
Yeah.
If you want to get an old cut of a film or a song that inspired you and you can't find the old version,
yeah,
you know, what do you do? So let's talk about it.
And copyright is forever now, it seems. Nothing ever seems to get into the public domain.
There's so much here. We're going to wrap it up. But I am looking forward to chatting about this more and seeing what our audience has to say about this. And I'm hoping that everybody has feedback for us that is more than a meme. So, you know, don't be a bot.
Don't be a bot. Leave a comment. Yeah, maybe we'll talk about this more, the newly weird ephemeral nature of media, because the internet was supposed to make things forever, and it hasn't. It's done the opposite. But
friendship is forever, because friendship is magic.
All right. Well, that's our show. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time in a couple of weeks, hopefully.
Adios, motherfuckers.
Grimm's Tales. Music by Casket Bound.